Hello there, and welcome to the episode number 12 of Dev Conversations by SwiftToolkit.dev, where we host developers that contribute to the Swift tooling ecosystem. Today, our guest is Bruno Rocha. Bruno is a Brazilian iOS developer living in Sweden, and he's mostly known for his blog, Swift Rocks, that covers advanced topics in software engineering. Hey Bruno, how's it going?
All good, thank you. Happy to be here and talk about Swift stuff.
Thanks for accepting. As I always do, tell me a little bit about your first steps in programming.
I started programming when I was a kid. So when I started professionally learning how to do things properly, I sort of like kind of knew a little bit already. Basically, I was a huge fan of those, you know, those old Newgrounds Flash animations back when Flash was still a huge thing. I think the first thing that I tried was playing around with Flash a little bit. I remember my dad gave me a programming book about the ActionScript at the time, and that's how a little bit I started playing with this. Then I started doing... I was always a video game fan, so I was always trying to play also with RPG Maker. That was like an engine from 20 years ago that you could make a sort of like Final Fantasy clone with very little to no coding. I think those were my first steps with programming, yeah. And then when I became an adult and I started getting into iOS development, that's when I started like learning like real programming.
For real, yeah. And do you have any formal academic background?
So I did game design actually because I wanted to start. So back then I was really into the idea that I wanted to work with game development, and I hated the idea of having to study theory, you know, algorithms, data structures, this sort of stuff. Now I really regret that, but at the time I thought like that. So I went into a game design course that we had in a university in my city in Brazil, because that was a very practical way to learn not just programming. So I could start learning game design as quickly as possible, which was the thing that I wanted to do, and there was like no theory involved. So that was sort of like my background. Mm-hmm. Other than that, after I left that, I worked a little bit with games, but then I decided that I wanted something more stable in my life because games industry is quite tough. So I had an opportunity in my city to do the Apple Developer Academy, where they teach people iOS development in Brazil and in some other countries too. And I was accepted into that, and that's how I moved into iOS.
Was it already Swift?
It was in the very beginning of Swift. I think it was maybe Swift 1.2. So I started learning Objective-C at this course thingy, and but very quickly we switched back into Swift.
Yeah, very nice.
And I was happy for that because that's how I got a good... I think like having a base in Objective-C is actually quite helpful for iOS, even nowadays, with all of the layers being in Objective-C. So I think that was a lucky timing on my front.
Yeah, I totally agree. I share some stuff in common. Programming for Flash and playing with Flash was also my first experience as something around this area, and I also learned by myself programming in Objective-C. And tell me, so your first real job was...
So it depends if we're talking on the game world or on the iOS world. So there's this company in Brazil called Movili. I think actually today they're called something else. This was a really long time ago. But they were a holding of a bunch of other companies, one of them being iFood, which is, at the time, I don't know how things are today because I left Brazil quite a long time ago. It was like the largest food delivery app there. And they had a really, really big app with lots of developers. And it was probably one of the only places in Brazil where you could actually work at that type of scale. And probably we were one of the first, together with some other companies that were similar to us, to actually bring some of these concepts to Brazil, I think. Because very few people were actually working at that size.
How big was the iOS team there?
I'm trying to remember if it was like close to 50 people.
Oh, wow.
Definitely more than 20. I don't remember the exact number. But it was quite a lot of people. There were a lot of people working remotely already at the time. That's why I don't know for sure. But I do remember we could easily fill one of those large meeting rooms for tons of people, almost like a conference thing. I would say close to 50, maybe.
What was the consequence of having such a big team, and how did you handle that?
So when you get to this kind of scale, this is where you start to notice that what we usually learn for iOS development doesn't really apply. Because a lot of the tips that you learn and what you see in those tutorial websites and so on, everything is kind of geared to a more small kind of app in terms of scale. Like maybe you have like 5 people working on something and you know, that's the entire company. But when you go to more than 50, things change a lot. Because a lot of these processes, they don't scale very well, especially Xcode. So one, probably the biggest example is that this level of company, they don't actually use Xcode at all in terms of building. You have the IDE because you don't have much choice. We may even talk a bit more about that later. But you don't actually use Xcode for building. You use either, at the time you had Buck and Bazel, today people just go straight into Bazel. They don't look into Buck at all. So you have all this sort of like custom infrastructure. And in Brazil, you didn't really have anyone who did that you could copy. We had to sort of, at the time of iFood, we had to research all this stuff
by ourselves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was a quite fun and challenging experience.
What can you tell about introducing Bazel in an app that is standard, 100% Xcode based? And yeah, for those who don't know, what can you also explain a little bit about Bazel?
Yeah, so Bazel is an alternate build system. When we say Xcode, we are usually referring to the whole package, the IDE and the building, but actually these are different things. You have the IDE Xcode, which is where you write the code, but you also have the Xcode build system, which is what gathers your files, processes the dependencies, and provides you with the final binary. The problem with Xcode is that, like the other things that we were talking about, Xcode is sort of like designed for very small projects. If you get to a certain scale, you will notice several flaws with Xcode. First of all, Xcode doesn't really do caching very well. So if you have like multiple projects and you have like libraries that are shared between these projects, what you want to do in practice is that if you compile a library for one project and then you move to the other project, you want to reuse this cache. Xcode doesn't really do that very well. Another problem is that Xcode doesn't let you do remote caching. So if I build something here on my machine, then in theory, if you build something on your machine that is exactly the same thing, you don't have to do that because I already built it. So I could transfer this cache to you and then things are faster for you. So there are lots of things like that we can talk about, and these are things that Xcode doesn't do. But when you go to a certain scale, you start needing those things. So, and this is what Bazel is. It's basically an alternative build system built by Google a long time ago that is essentially built for this type of scale. So if you look at it, you see it's completely different. The way you define builds, how you move things around, there's a whole setup for it. But it's really worth it for this kind of company. The downside is that it's very tricky to maintain, so this is why you don't see this being recommended overall, even though it sounds like a good idea. It's not because it's very hard to use. So people usually only do this at large companies because you generally need very specialized teams to do this. So people who their entire job is actually just maintaining,
making this sure that this works well.
And this is what we created at iFood at the time. We created a team for this. And then we saw I was part of that. And then we saw this is actually how all those big companies operate. If you go to Google, Uber, here's Spotify, they all have like platforming divisions that they call. And these platform divisions, they're people who are staffed specifically to maintain this sort of like very complex infrastructure that you need at this level, essentially.
Yeah, that makes sense. And from there, you moved on to Spotify, right? Which is where you're currently at?
Yeah. I moved to Spotify 5 years ago in 2020, just before COVID. Mm-hmm. And I joined in to essentially do the same thing. I joined the platforming division. I started working more directly with iOS, which is what I was doing in iFood, so taking care of the architecture of the app itself and those like infra-ish details, but very specific to iOS. And nowadays, I do something more general. I take care of like infrastructure, period. So not necessarily the iOS app, but the entire repo and all of the other client offerings that we have. So the Android app, we have like a C++ layer that connects everything, the sort of stuff. So I look nowadays, I'm at the level of abstraction lower than what I used to do.
And what things fascinate you the most?
So I always really like understanding how things work under the hood. And when you work with this sort of like platformy thing, you have a lot of space to really look at how things work under the hood. Like, how does the Swift compiler handles a specific type of thing that you write in the code? How does that actually translate to the binary? What are the steps in between? How is the compiler involved? What are the flags involved into this? How you can modify this? Because when you, if you're trying to optimize things like, oh, I just want to make the builds as fast as possible or make the binary as small as possible, you end up getting into this sort of rabbit hole. And personally, I'm lucky that I actually enjoy this sort of stuff. That's part of how I even started the blog. It's just like looking into how things work in the compiler and then taking notes of it and then publishing it. And in this job, I'm basically paid to do this sort of stuff. So it's very fun.
Everybody wins.
Yeah.
And how do you begin this? Because it's not a standard programming routine, right? Which tools do you use and how is the cycle? Because let's say when programming for iOS, we do, you build your view model or your models, controllers, and you iterate over it. How is the cycle for this kind of job?
I think the tooling is not so different. It's just what you're looking at. So for example, if I'm trying to optimize cloning in the repo, so I just want cloning to be fast, it's not necessarily a matter of that I'm coding something else. It's just the nature of the research. So if you're doing iOS things, you go to, at the time, you would go to Stack Overflow, you would search your problem, and then you have your whole discussion there. The difference here is that I have other places to look at. Maybe I have the actual Git source code on GitHub. I look at discussions from a really long time ago where they mentioned change logs and sort of stuff. There are different Slack workspaces for this sort of stuff. Like there's a big Bazel Slack, for example. With a lot of people from big companies, there you can have some interesting discussions about this kind of work. But there's also a lot of reverse engineering work that I like, and that will actually answer your question. There's, for example, one tool that I use a lot that's called Hopper, which is a disassembler. So when I have questions, for example, how is Xcode doing this thing when I press this button, I look at the assembly code, and I try to piece things together based on this tool, which helps us, like, retranslate assembly back into something that is kind of the original source code, but not really. So there are lots of things like that. And also, I actually have it right next to me, there are lots of books about this sort of stuff. So this is called, one is called Art of Mac Malware. It sounds completely unrelated, but usually these sorts of books, they tell you how Mac works. So if you're trying to just debug things and understanding how things work,
I'm sure
these resources, they tell you how to do this sort of stuff. So that's also how I learn a lot of things related.
This book is in your list of book recommendations, isn't it?
Yeah, I read the first one. This is the second edition. I'm still trying to get through it.
Cool. And yeah, and this sort of work is also, you have one Swift Evolution proposal that was accepted and implemented. It's SE 290. Can we talk a little bit about that? How was the process and how did you implement this? At what levels?
Yeah, I guess that must be the availability one. Because I have done a couple of things for... Yes. Because I pushed a couple of PRs to Swift, mostly on the indexing part, because I had this project called Swift Shield that relied on that. So that's a little bit of how I got to know a little bit of the Swift compiler. But this thing there, the context is that we were trying to do, at the time, we called reverse availability check, because I don't remember where exactly, what exactly I was working at the time, but I remember we had something in the app delegate that we wanted to do a check, not if something was available, but if something was not available. But this was not possible in Swift because back then, I think it's not the case anymore, you couldn't store the result of availability into a property. You had to actually just write the whole thing. And then I figured out, oh, this is an interesting project to learn more about Swift. So I open up Xcode, I cloned the entire Swift source code, and little by little, using those debugging tricks that I was mentioning from these resources, I kind of start piecing things together. And eventually I was able to do it. But it took a lot of reviewing work from the Apple folks, so certainly wouldn't be able to do it alone. But it's an example of if you put the time to understand how things work, you can really work with this type of stuff, even if it looks extremely complicated.
And you mentioned Swift Shield. This is the next topic I wanted to talk a little bit about.
This is something that I don't do much of anymore, but back then, like more than 5 years ago, I was using open source projects as a way to just learn more about coding in general, just practice. And one project that I had was this thing called Swift Shield, which was basically the first, I think, code-based code obfuscator for iOS. So you get their entire source code, you run that, and this thing will actually just make everything gibberish so that you can publish on the store, and then people have a hard time getting through that. And the reason is because if you know a little bit of Objective-C, you learn that all of your function names and classes, this sort of stuff, it gets shipped into your compiled code. So it's very easy for someone to inspect how your code works. So if you have something that is like more sensitive, you may have an argument to try to just make gibberish out of that just to make it harder. And the way I implemented that was in the Swift compiler, they have this thing called SourceKit, which is basically the indexing engine. It's the thing that if you pass a certain piece of code, it will tell you what that is. Like, oh, this is actually a reference to this other class that is referenced in this other place. And this is what does the code completion and highlighting in Xcode. So when you see everything painted correctly, what is doing that in the background is this thing called SourceKit. And you can use that separately. So I found a way to do that. I saw lots of tutorials from different people. And I was able to grab something that compile your app, run everything through SourceKit, so I could tell, oh, this class is used here, here, and here. Okay, so I'm going to replace all of this with some gibberish, essentially.
But it's not a build phase.
So I have to do a build on the background to make that happen. That is basically the context. But you can just run it whenever you want. But the thing is that SourceKit is not perfect. It works to a big extent, but there are some issues in the database that it produces. So that's why if you look at the repo today, there's this big warning say, probably this will not work perfectly unless you have like a mostly simple project. And then I got tired of Swift updates breaking the tool because they used to change SourceKit all the time, add new Swift features, and this would cause bugs. And eventually I said, okay, I don't want to fix this anymore. But the good thing is that because of this project, I opened lots of PRs to the Swift compiler to fix these sort of like small issues in the indexing. So I think that's a cool thing that I was able to do because of it.
Yeah, for sure. And you have this other project, right? For supporting Swift development in other IDEs?
Yeah, so what I'm working right now, I haven't like officially publicly announced this, but the repo is public, so it's already out there for everyone to see. We'll make a bigger announcement sometime next week. But what I have been playing around recently was precisely with the idea of not needing to use Xcode anymore for iOS development, because for companies of our size, this is a little bit of a problem. Historically, so the reason this was not a thing is not because necessarily Apple didn't want it to, it's just that nobody pieced everything together. Because Apple always had the Swift language server protocol, the LSP, which is basically what modern IDEs use to add functionality for certain programming languages, and Swift always had that. So you could always use Swift for like VS Code, Cursor, this sort of stuff. It's just that the LSP itself was hard-coded to only work with Swift Package Manager, so you couldn't use it for iOS development specifically. But what happened is that in last November, Apple actually opened this up. So you can now sort of like hook the LSP into something else that they call a build server protocol. And as long as you implement this build server protocol correctly, you can make Swift work with anything on any IDE that supports that. So at Spotify, we built this, including
iOS.
Including iOS.
Right, because we have the Swift... the official Swift plugin for VS Code or Cursor, but it doesn't support iOS. That's what you were saying.
Yeah, so the plugin installs the LSP, but the LSP, by default, it only does Swift Package Manager. But if someone builds this thing called the Build Server Protocol for Xcode, which people have, you can find it already on Google, then you can actually use that for iOS on those IDEs that have
and
those extensions.
And launch simulators and so on.
It's the building part, but in theory, yes, you can build those abstractions. But what we did at Spotify was to build one of these for Bazel specifically. So it's on GitHub already. We will announce this better sometime next week. But using this, you can actually build Bazel-based iOS projects in any IDE that has those LSPs. So in my case, I use Cursor, and yeah. So if you're doing something that doesn't require like very specific Xcode tooling, like, you know, those memory debuggers, you have the SwiftUI previews and sort of stuff. If you're just working more generically and you don't need those special things, then with this tool, you can just skip Xcode entirely. You can have all the building, the simulator launching, the LLDB debugging, all into, in my case, I use Cursor, but this will also use in VX Code and probably a bunch of other stuff too, even like Sublime Text if you have the LSP plugin. So yeah, this is something that I'm very excited about because personally I never really like using Xcode at scale. Some people like it, but also probably they're probably on smaller projects, which is Xcode main focus, and for that for sure it works very well. But on larger projects, it's just a mess. The entire format of Xcode projects is very hard to deal with.
It doesn't scale so much. Yeah. Yeah. Congrats on such an achievement. And to wrap up, if you could leave some tips for people who want to get deeper on software engineering at all and Swift development, what are your tips?
Yeah, something that I always say, even on many of the posts that I wrote, is that there's a huge benefit to learning how things work under the hood because it helps you make more informed decisions. You know, people talk a lot about, oh, this API does this, this API does that, and like, what should I use? And often you can find out the answer to those things by just knowing what happens under the hood. If you just use what's given to you without regards to what actually is enabling that to be possible, you can code, you know, everyone does that, but you don't really know what is going on. So you can say that you have control over what you're doing. But if you take the time to actually understand things, you see that you can develop some pretty powerful stuff and make some very, very strong optimizations on your code and, you know, just be able to do anything really. Tips on how to do that. I have a couple of book recommendations that teach you this, like for macOS specifically. It's just so you know how to debug stuff. If you want to look at how some software was built, you can decompile that. Debugging tricks. What else? Terminal tricks. There's a lot of really good terminal CLIs that is already installed on your Mac, but nobody knows because it's like very underground stuff, but also very powerful.
Can you give some examples?
I have this thing that I use a lot that is called pgrep, which is basically, it's the same as looking at the process list, which people might know is this PS aux for looking at what's running on their Mac, but it's for just very quickly locating instances of certain programs. And then with that result, you have the identifier of a program, and then with that, you can just do like infinite other things. You can inspect the state of the program, you can look at what the programming is doing under the hood, like which file descriptors they are looking at, which is just like this whole other topic. So like it just goes forever, the types of things that you can learn with this.
Anything else?
I feel like curiosity is a very strong motivator for some of this stuff.
And if people want to find out more about your work and your blog posts, where they can find you?
Yeah, you can find me at swiftrocks.com. There you have everything that I'm doing, essentially, and contact information if you want to reach out, socials and all of this stuff. I put everything there nowadays.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Bruno. We'll be in touch.
Thank you, Nathan.
Bye.
Thank you, everyone.